Chapter 19. With its uncomfortably close G1 sun blazing down through a heat-bleached sky, the temperature along the entire 150-kilometer length of Venice coast rose uncompromisingly during the day. It didn't help that the beautiful island city was only just outside what was technically Anacona's northern polar region, and the planet was also approaching the middle of summer. This mix of geography and calendar was currently giving the city over 16 hours of intense sunlight every day. In deep winter, of course, the pattern would be reversed, and the sun would only be visible for about 6 hours a day. Even then, the climate would cool down to something like Earth's Mediterranean temperatures. Anacona's proximity to its primary star made the planet uninhabitable from the equator out to 50 degrees latitude north and south, most of which was a rocky desert. From space, Anacona had the same kind of symmetrical banded appearance as a gas giant, with its broad expanse of coffee-colored sands wrapped around the center, and skirted with black and auburn mountain ranges. The planet had kicked off a large and ongoing debate among Commonwealth planetologists about how climate could affect topography, or if the symmetry was just a transient tectonic fluke. For it wasn't just the central regions that were regular. Beyond the peaks that bounded each side of the desert, the cornflower-blue waters of annular seas sparkled in the strong sun to the north and the south. Both the polar zones boasted continents, although the southern one was smaller, and their coastlines were completely dissimilar. They did share an abundance of emerald vegetation, with rainforests and grasslands nurtured by the heat and daily rains. Both seas shunted long trails of swan-white cloud across the continents, where they formed permanent, slow-spinning spiral whirls over the actual poles. The sea gave Venice coast an indecent humidity. By mid-afternoon, the siesta was well underway, hustling tourists and inhabitants alike off the streets. Shops shut for 4 or 5 hours at a time, waiting until evening and a low golden sun before they opened their doors again. People took long rests in the shaded courtyard gardens to be found at the center of every block. The only service that carried on regardless was the monorail, which linked every district along the narrow city's 150-kilometer length. Even most of the gondolas, water taxis, and little supply boats that swarmed the canals tied up at some quay or other, bobbing about empty while their skippers lounged around in the bars. It was these long, people-less interludes every day that gave Paula Mayo her greatest cause for concern. The surveillance operation would be much better served by crowds and activity providing cover for the agency's operatives. As it was, they had to linger over long meals and drinks as they sat on the verandas of neighboring cafes and restaurants. It was proving a popular duty. Paula disapproved. They were likely to grow lax during such leisurely episodes. The center of their attention was the Nystol Gallery, a big three-story canal-side building in the Cesena district that specialized in EK art, electrokinetic machines with hundreds or even thousands of moving parts. Paula had reviewed the gallery's catalog, going virtual through the TSI construct, where she marveled, as every non-art lover did, at the striking, pointless fusion of art and machine. Some were like working sculptures of animals, aliens, and mythical creatures, their microgears and pistons running through biological functions with cheeky mimicry, while others were random collections of mechanical components assembled in bizarre asymmetric patterns that shouldn't work, yet somehow managed to buzz, whir, rotate, and wobble about with jerky elegance. Still others were variants of the old domino relay, with modules of fire, water, air, rubber, protoplasm, and ordinary misapplied components from domestic or industrial machines, all of them reacting against each other, activating the next piece, then somehow resetting themselves in an impossible perpetual motion. The Nystol was a good cover for its owner, a Mr. Valtar Rigin, whose other specialist enterprise was black market armaments. For a start, Venice coast was not the kind of city where such activities took place. It had no industry other than art and fishing and boats and tourism. There had been no grand civic cultural plan back when it started in 2200, no desire to rival the illustrious ancient urban areas of Earth or the dynamic wealth-hungry new cities vying for funds and entrepreneurs that were springing up across Phase 2 space. This was built on a dream and a prayer, starting on a sandy spit called Prato, near the center of an 800-kilometer stretch of swampy coastline on the Kalitri continent that was protected to seaward by meandering lines of small marshy islands. Local marine life attracted several families who'd arrived from Italy and were already tiring of the new planet's capital, San Marino. The waters were thriving with a variety of edible fish, eminently suitable to Italian cuisine. Several of the families who settled on the spit were from Old Venice, so that boating culture was there right from the start. Huge dredges imported from the mega shipyards on Verona scooped out big channels for the fishing boats, then began clearing smaller channels around Prato. More substantial houses started getting built on the higher, reclaimed land, with little canals dug directly to them so the boats could have easy access. That was when the growing town's inhabitants realized the potential of what they had. The original spit began to expand as the newly dredged swamp silt was piled up on the east and west sides. After a couple of years, Prato had become an elongated island with a wide, clear lagoon separating it from the main coast where the swamp had once been, with a single causeway for the railway lines. It set the pattern for the future. For 180 years, the dredges and construction bots just kept on going. The Long Island twisted sinuously many times to keep more or less parallel to the contours of the coast, with districts continually added to both ends. Architects, artisans, and designers collaborated with City Hall to keep their new commissions Italianate in nature, preserving and amplifying the waterbound city's character. It became fashionable for grand families and intersolar dynasties and the individual super wealthy to own a villa somewhere along Venice coast. The thousands of offshore islands proved even more lucrative real estate. The Cesena district, where the Nystol Gallery was situated, lay 30 kilometers east of Prato, 3 stops on the express monorail. After 4 days, Paula knew it intimately, every street, canal, bridge, covered alleyway, and square. Her hotel was 7.5 minutes' walk from the local monorail station, with 5 bridges over the canals, 3 of carved stone, 1 wood, and 1 metal. The Nystol was 4.5 minutes, and 3 bridges, while the local police station was a mere 2 minutes, with 4 bridges in the way. She'd arrived at Venice Coast with a team of 8 from her office, supplemented by a further 5 from technical support, and 30 officers from the Tactical Assault Division. 12 of Anacona's senior detectives had been loaned to her by the planet's eager interior minister, providing invaluable assistance down on the narrow waterways and maze of streets where it was really needed. Their presence was an indicator of how much importance governments placed on the new Commonwealth Planetary Security Agency, the quiet twin of the Commonwealth Starflight Agency. With the launch of the scout ships back to Dyson Alpha, public interest had been focused solely on the Starflight Agency. Now the Planetary Security Agency was receiving 55% of the overall budget. For someone who'd scraped in on a pitiful 58% of the intersolar vote, President Doi was strangely forceful when it came to providing funds for the new agency. There was talk on the Unisphere news shows that income tax was going to have to be raised to pay for the vastly expanded facilities. Greater resources should have helped ease the transition for Paula. She didn't like it at all. The agency wasn't the directorate she'd joined, even if reorganization had brought her more money and a bigger staff. That staff now unfortunately included Alec Hogan, her new deputy, who Columbia had appointed from his own legal department. If ever there was a political placeman, it was Hogan. His constant requests for full briefings from all the investigators and insistence that all procedures were conducted by the book were causing a lot of resentment in the Paris office. He knew very little about running a case, and everything about watching over people's shoulders. Over the last few months, she'd begun to wonder if she was becoming conservative in her old age, hating change simply because it was change, refusing to acknowledge that society was altering around her. It surprised her, because if nothing else, she considered herself a realist. Police forces always adapted to keep pace with the civilization in which they maintained order. Although, more likely, it was the increasing degree of political control exerted over agency operatives that made her uncomfortable. She resented the notion that limits might be imposed over her own work. After so many years served, to reach a virtually semi-autonomous position, it would be awful to be hauled back into the general accounting system. Like everyone else.
Excuse me? Tarlo asked.
Paula gave her deputy a mildly irritated smile. She hadn't realized she'd spoken out loud.
Nothing. Thinking aloud.
Sure, Tarlo said, and returned to the menu. His California attitude was something Paula could finally appreciate here. Tarlo merged perfectly into Venice Coast's laid-back lifestyle. The two of them were sitting at a cafe table under a broad parasol by the side of the Clade Canal. 300 meters away, on the opposite side, was the back of the Nystol Gallery. Its sheer red brick wall rose vertically out of the placid water, with only a single loading door on the lower floor, a meter or so above the black tide line. A couple of wooden mooring posts stood on either side of it, their white and blue stripes sun-scorched to near invisibility. Wide, stone-rimmed windows marked out the second and third floors, below an overhanging roof of red clay tiles. A row of thick semi-organic precipitator leaves were draped just below the guttering, as if some giant vine was growing out of the rafters. Fresh water was an expensive commodity in Venice Coast. By themselves, the sieve wells drilled through the basement of most blocks couldn't support the huge demand of the residents. Paula's seat was positioned so she faced the target building, while Tarlo was at right angles to her, giving him a view along the canal. In his white cap and loose orange and black linen shirt, he seemed immune to the heat. Paula took off her suit jacket and hung it on the back of the chair before sitting down. Her white blouse was clinging to her skin. Her wig was hot. She could feel the sweat prickling her brow, but she resisted the impulse to shift it around. A waiter from the cafe scowled at them from his seat just inside the doorway. When it was clear they weren't going to go away, he sauntered over.
Ah, uno acqua minerale, natur, Paula began.
The waiter gave her a pitying sigh.
Still or sparkling?
Oh, still, please. Chilled and with ice.
The Venice Coast waiters were normally contemptuous of anyone who couldn't speak even a smattering of Italian. Tarlo asked for a non-alcoholic beer and a bowl of smoked raisol nuts. Both of them received a further look of utter derision, before the waiter slumped his shoulders and walked back inside.
Always feels good to blend right on in there, Tarlo said.
He put his sandaled feet up on the rusting iron railing that guarded the edge of the granite cobbled pavement from the canal. Paula checked her timer.
We'll order more drinks in half an hour, then a snack after that.
I'd love to have at least 2 hours here.
Boss, we've got the whole place covered by sensors, you know. You can't get a carrier pigeon in there without us zapping it.
I know. Target review is important to me. I need to get a feel for the op.
Yeah, Tarlo grinned.
So you keep telling me.
If one good thing had come out of the directorate becoming the security agency, it was the expanded intelligence base. For once, the news of Valtar Rigin purchasing a number of sophisticated and very restricted items of technology hadn't come from any of Paula's deep assets. Instead, Anacona's Special Criminal Bureau had been running a monitoring operation with local manufacturers who made dual-use products. They ran financial checks on an industrial supply company that purchased some molecular resonance stabilizers with a very high power rating, the kind that could be used in large force field generators. It turned out the supply company was a shell, with its credit supplied from a one-time bank account on St. Lincoln. The Bureau tracked the shipment, which was routed through a number of blind drops, until a courier picked it up and delivered it to the gallery. That was when they called the agency in. Observation, back-tracking, and communications monitors had shown them Rigin was acquiring a lot of dual-use components. There were no actual weapons, but the pattern fitted one of Adam Alvin's shipment operations exactly.
He picked a good cover, Paula said as she sipped her mineral water. I'll bet you Rigin's lawyer claims that the components make up one of his EK works.
So why did he need to acquire them like this?
Paula smiled in the shade of the parasol as a light breeze washed off the canal.
Radical art, I expect.
You reckon he's going to ship it all out at once?
Most likely. The risk was in putting the items together.
Now he's exporting,
It'll be a couple of big crates to a legitimate destination. Right out the back door, huh? Yes. From behind her big sunglasses, Paula gazed at the solid grey-painted wood of the gallery's loading door, visualizing the cargo boat tying up beside it, the containers being lowered onto the deck. They'd do it in the middle of the day, of course. A simple, honest shipment, nothing to hide. Wherever it went, out to the docks that fronted the Acre district, where the big sea-going ships put in, or the cargo yard at the Prato monorail station, she'd follow it. Somewhere down the line, Bradley Johansson would be waiting. Adam Alvin leaned back against the purple cord cushions in the back of the gondola as it slid gracefully along the narrow canal. It was one of the little waterways that zigzagged around large blocks, connecting and crossing the larger canals. The side walls were high here, slimed with weed and dirt. Water slapped against a cracked brickwork, slowly eroding the mortar. There were entire sections that had been repaired with new bricks and hard cement, looking totally out of place. Bridges curved overhead like miniature tunnels. Each block had a row of near-identical blank wooden doors a meter above the tide line, fastened by heavy iron bolts. They passed several that were open, with little cargo boats tied up outside, their crew manhandling crates and boxes into the dark interiors. Every delivery in Venice Coast was by boat, adding to the cost of living here. Adam hadn't appreciated that before he came, that the only transport in each district was either walking or boat. The monorail took you between districts, but that was all. They turned out onto the famous Rovigo Canal, one of the major channels through the Cesena district. The venturi trees lined both sides. Planted a century ago, their trunks resembled gnarled copper pillars reaching over 25 meters high, with arched boughs that trailed long strands of yellow-gold leaves as thin as tissue. Each one had its own sieve well that had been drilled under the pavement into the boggy subsoil, allowing the roots to suck up fresh water. Adam was lucky enough to be visiting during the fortnight they were in bloom. Each branch ended in a triune of brilliant amethyst rough flowers as big as footballs. Already, though, petals were beginning to fade and fall, snowing onto the heads of delighted gondola tourists like scented confetti. Adam smiled appreciatively as the gondolier slowed down, allowing him to soak up the sight and smell of the wonderful native trees. The boutiques and galleries on either side of the Rovigo were among the more exclusive in Venice Coast, with dark glass windows illustrating single examples of their expensive prestige products. Not far away, the strange and wonderful twisted neo-Gothic spire of St. Peter's Cathedral towered above the city's red tile roofs, like a pre-Commonwealth silver space rocket. The Rovigo ended at a junction with the Clade Canal. They waited between the last of the venturi trees for a big glass-topped, air-conditioned tourist bus boat to chug past. The wash slapped at the gondola, much to the gondolier's disgust. Half of his conversation during the trip had been a diatribe against any boat that had an engine. Adam looked along the Clade, seeing the broad waterway slowly curving away from him, with the back of the Nystol gallery just visible. There were only about 10 other boats on this section, a couple of gondolas, some cargo boats, a taxi. The pavement along the side was equally empty, with a few tourists wandering along. Even the cafes were almost deserted. "Stop!" Adam hissed at the gondolier. The man looked back at him in surprise, the pole poised, ready to push them out into the Clade now the water bus had passed. "He's clear now," he complained. "Go back. Do not go out onto the Clade. Understand, do not take me out there. Take me back to the monorail station." He produced a thick roll of notes from his pocket and peeled off over 100 Anacona dollars. The gondolier's face brightened at the sight of the money. "Sure. Okay. You're the captain. I'm just the engine room." He changed the angle of the pole and slid it into the muddy water. The gondola's prow slowly came around, and they began to head back down the Rovigo. A multitude of crispy, dry, violet petals continued to drift down over Adam's clothes as they retreated at a speed that was barely above walking pace. He refused to look around. That would be a stupid weakness. He knew exactly who he'd seen sitting there outside the cafe. After all this time, he could recognize Chief Investigator Mayo's profile from almost any angle and distance.
She was wearing a blonde wig and large sunglasses, but that couldn't disguise her from him. Her posture, her gestures, that suit. Who the hell else would wear a business suit in the middle of Venice Coast siesta? His limbs were starting to shake as he realized how close he'd come to the end of, well, everything. He must have just used up every scrap of luck from the rest of his lifetime. If he'd been looking the other way, if Mayo hadn't been on duty at this time of day. He'd undergone cellular reprofiling, of course, giving himself a new image, a drawn face with dark skin. But he knew that wouldn't have worked with the chief investigator. She would know him as easily as he knew her. They could never hide from each other. He walked into the nice old gallery by the front door, knowing the agency team would have his image on record. It didn't bother him. The reception hall had an arching roof of white painted brick and a flagstone floor. Before being converted into a gallery, the building had been a storage warehouse, which made it an ideal place to house EK pieces. The receptionist sat at a desk in front of a smoked glass doorway that led into the gallery's display chambers. She was staggeringly pretty, with a sylph body, Nordic white skin and red-gold hair that hung halfway down her back. Her flimsy brown and emerald dress belonged on a couture's house's runway. She smiled automatically at him, which deepened to mildly flirtatious as he walked over.
"Hi, can I help you?"
"No." He shot her through the temple with a micro-dart from his arm dispenser. Its impulse locked her muscles solid, an instant rigor mortis, holding her upright in her seat. Anyone peering in from the street would see her behind the desk as usual. His e-butler opened a channel to the desk's array. A brief software battle ensued as he took control of the building's electronics network. As it progressed, the weapons and defense systems wet-wired into his body powered up, bringing him to full combat status. He disconnected the gallery's network from the planetary cybersphere, then deactivated all the internal alarms. The front door was locked. Where possible, fire doors were silently sealed, compartmentalizing the gallery. Sensors fed directly into his virtual vision, showing him the location of several people, although he knew there were at least three rooms without sensors. The first chamber housed a 3-meter-high EK Griffin, with a body made from thin sheets of jewel-encrusted brass that moved with fluid grace as they were manipulated from within by hundreds of small cogs and micro-pistons. It was as if Leonardo da Vinci had animated a sculpture with a difference engine. An old couple were walking around it, making admiring noises as they pointed out features to each other. He shot both of them with an ion bolt. The griffin cooed loudly as he moved into the second chamber. On the second floor, the fifth chamber had a single strip of machinery running its entire length, each component coming from the same aircraft, and broken in some way, so instead of the smooth movement associated with the aerospace industry, they jerked around like a damaged bird when power was applied. Ripples of motion ran up and down the strip, each one different to the last. A gallery guide was walking along the side of the piece, with a frown on his face, as he came to investigate the strange sounds that had burst out of the fourth chamber. The ion bolt vaporized the top of his skull. Blood steam misted the workings of a wing flap electrohydraulic activator, slowing its motion. Loud rattling sounds began to issue up and down the whole length of the EK piece as its synchronization was thrown off and stresses built up. He went up to the third floor. Valtar Ridgin's office was the second door along the hallway. Like the chambers below, it had a vaulting brickwork ceiling. At the far end, an arched window gave a splendid view out over the Cesena district, with St. Peter's mirachrome spire framed almost dead center. Ridgin looked up in surprise from behind his desk, where he'd been struggling with his crashed network interface.
"Who the hell are you?"
"You are Valtar Ridgin?" Ridgin smiled thinly. "Roberto," he called quietly. A large black leather couch had been placed on the left side of the door, so it would remain unseen by anyone who entered the office until they were well inside the room. He had, of course, sensed the human male sitting on it. The man, presumably Roberto, who was now lifting his 7-foot-high frame onto his very large feet.
He brought his left arm up and fired an ion pulse straight through the door at the big human's head. Roberto, as a good bodyguard, was wearing a light armor frame below his expensive hand-tailored suit, which wrapped him in a deflector field. The ion bolt sizzled loudly as it bounced off into the brickwork. Carbonized clay puffed out of the strike point. Roberto slammed both hands into the door, which ripped off its hinges. He barely noticed the impact as the door crashed against him. His arm sliced around hard, smashing 3-inch-thick hardwood into splinter shrapnel. Roberto grunted in surprise and went for the weapon in his shoulder holster in a slick, high-speed motion only available to those with a nervous system wet-wired for accelerated response time. The bulky Mag-A pistol that he pulled out fired 2 depleted uranium rounds at the intruder, whose sparkling force field halted both of them. That was the only chance Roberto got. He launched himself straight at the big man, right leg swinging up and around to kick the ribs. Roberto shrieked as the blow punched clean through the armor frame. 3 ribs broke and pushed inward, puncturing his lungs. The bodyguard ignored the pain and countered with a left twist, his right arm coming around flat, aimed for the intruder's neck, armor frame's E-dump function on and eager to wreck the other's force field. Energy flared from the impact like a fusion bloom, the blinding discharge flinging off slivers of static that clawed at both figures as they grounded out. But the E-dump never got anywhere near overloading the force field. A fist, like the front end of an express train, crashed into Roberto's side, sending him flying backward through the air to smack into the curving brickwork. Trailers of blood smeared the white paint as he slithered down limply to the polished wooden floorboards. He leaped gracefully across the intervening distance, one heel coming down on Roberto's leg. The knee joint snapped with a sickening crunch under his heel. Roberto threw up as hands grasped the lapels on his ruined suit, hauling him to his feet. It was difficult for Roberto to focus through the days of pain, but he just managed to squint at the intruder's frighteningly emotionless features. Then the headbutt caved in the front of Roberto's face, pushing several splintered fragments of bone from the fractured skull directly into his brain. He dropped the dead bodyguard and turned to face the terrified man behind the desk. "You are Valter Rigen?"
"Yes."
Rigen crossed himself, his eyes watering as he waited to die. "I do not have time to torture information from you. If you do not cooperate, I will destroy your memory cell insert when I kill your body. Then we will infiltrate your re-life clinic and erase your secure store. You will be genuinely dead. We do have the capability to do this. Do you believe me?" Rigen nodded frantically.
"Holy Mother of God, who are you?"
His eyes flicked to the broken corpse of his bodyguard.
"How did you—"
"The location of the equipment you are buying for Adam Elvin?"
"I—" "That wasn't the name he gave me, but everything for the deal I'm putting together right now is in the second storeroom at the end of the hallway. All of it, I swear."
"Give me the file containing the list of components and the methods of payment to your encrypted bank accounts. I also want the export route." He ordered his e-butler to open a channel to the terrified arms merchant. Information flowed into his cache. The ion bolt blew a wide hole through Rigen's chest. He hurried over to the corpse and bent down. A single slender harmonic blade slid out from underneath his right index finger, and he quickly cut through the neck to pull out a bloody gob of flesh and bone that contained all of Rigen's inserts. With the arms merchant's memory cell safe in his pocket, he walked down the hallway to the second storeroom. A single kick shattered the reinforced polytanium door. There were 3 crates in the windowless room, all unsealed, with packaging foam scattered around them. He went over to the first, checked to see that it did contain high-technology items, then dropped a super-thermal demolition charge in. To exit the gallery, he went back to Rigen's office. He stood in front of the window and activated a focused disruptor field. The entire window of toughened carbon glass shattered before him, its cascade of shards twinkling in the brilliant sunlight as they flew outward. He followed them, sailing through the warm outside air in a perfect swan dive to land cleanly in the clayed canal with a small splash. Underwater, he put his feet together and kept his arms by his side. A ripple of motion swept down his body, and he powered forward with the ease of a dolphin through the muddy water. his enhanced senses showing him the canal walls on either side of the boats above. The superthermal charge exploded behind him. His training had been hard, not just physically, Casimir had expected that, but mentally too. The things he'd had to learn, the Commonwealth's history, its current affairs, the multitude of planets and their accompanying cultures, technology, programs, endless programs, and how they managed his new inserts. There had been so many times over the last 2 years when he just wanted to shout, "I quit," at Stig and his other tormentor tutors. But the thought of Bruce stayed with him through all those months spent moving between the secret clan villages of the Dassault Mountains. He competed against the memory, thinking how Bruce would never quit, never turn tail. Now, finally, Casimir stood on Santa Monica's sandy beach, facing the water as the morning sun rose slowly behind Los Angeles, and admitted it had all been worthwhile. A pleasant wind blew in off the Pacific Ocean, ruffling the waves, while the first limousines and coupes of the morning's commuter traffic slid silently and cleanly along the Pacific Coast Highway. To his left was the Santa Monica Pier, extending a kilometer out into the ocean, its ancient, original structure, a platform of wood and metal and concrete, gradually blended into the first of the three extensions that had been grafted onto it during its 4 centuries' lifetime. Out to sea, the newer components of Psi carbon and glass and hyperfilament girders had been arranged in mock organic forms, sometimes discreet, sometimes deliberately garish, especially where the funfair rides were stationed along the east side. He'd been so tempted to walk along it yesterday when he arrived, maybe go on a couple of the rides, fit the profile of a visiting tourist mark. After all, that's what he genuinely was. It was a testament to Stig's training that he resisted, though he suspected, had Bruce been here with him, they would have sneaked off and done it, for old time's sake. Instead, he'd done what he was supposed to do, registered at the hotel behind the 3rd Street promenade with its smart ancient shops that pulled in locals as well as visitors, scouted the area, acquainting himself with the grid of streets, noted access to public transport points for escape, which hotel lobbies were open and the building's exits, position of civic buildings, rough timings for police patrol cars on the main roads, location of public observation anti-crime sensors. The reconnaissance had given him a good feel for the city, and he'd been impressed with what he saw, its wealth, neatness, and style. He'd been on a few Commonwealth worlds now, enough that he wasn't completely intimidated by urban areas that covered hundreds of square kilometers. But this particular part of Los Angeles had threatened to undo all that acclimatization. He hadn't been prepared for how shiny and clean it all was. After all, most of the cities on the New Worlds had large districts that were crumbling into ghetto status. Here, where age had every chance to pour entropy and decay into entire neighborhoods, the residents had resisted. Money helped, of course, and there was plenty of it residing among the condos fronting Ocean Avenue and the exclusive houses between San Vicente Boulevard and Montana Avenue. But there was more to it than that. It was as if Santa Monica had discovered how to continually rejuvenate itself, just like the humans who built and lived in it. For all its age, it had a buoyant, vivacious atmosphere, making it a fun and friendly place to be. Surprisingly, Casimir thought he might actually be able to live here, if he was forced to live anywhere on Earth, that is. Big city-owned tractor bots were slowly grinding their way along the beach just above the water, fluffing up the dense sand and leveling it, ready for the day. Cyclists, joggers, power walkers, ordinary walkers, dog walkers, skaters, ped crawlers, and N-scoots were starting to appear on the path that wound along the back of the beach. Casimir was getting used to Commonwealth citizens and their eternal quest for looks and fitness, but the highest concentration of obsessive personalities surely had to be on Earth. Everyone on the path was dressed in high-fashion sportswear, no matter what age, from mid-twenties up to approaching rejuve 50. It was an effort for him not to smile at them as they sweated their way along, faces intent and frowning. As he watched them idly, he realized how few young people were using the path, but then that was true of Earth in general. The number of children he'd seen here so far was very small. One of the early morning walkers left the path and headed over the sand toward him. It was an exceptionally tall man in his 30s, with blonde hair that, under the Californian sunlight, was almost pure white. In contrast, his eyes were very dark, making his face stand out rather than appear classically attractive. He was wearing a simple white V-necked jersey, knee-length shorts, and midnight black trainers. Casimir McFoster, I presume. He put his hand out. There was no hesitancy, no caution that he might have got the wrong person. Yes. It took every piece of self-control for Casimir not to stammer or gawp incredulously. You're Bradley Johansson. Were you expecting someone else? About half the cops on the planet. Bradley nodded appreciatively. Thank you for coming. Thank you for giving me the chance. It's still kind of hard to believe you're real. Alive, I mean. I spent so many years learning what you've done for us, the stand you took, what it cost you. He waved an arm at the city above the cliff. It's an outrage they don't believe you. Let's walk, Bradley said. We ought to try and blend in. Casimir wasn't sure if he'd offended the great man. More likely, he'd simply bored him. How many times must Bradley have heard something similar from stupid, awe-struck youngsters? Sure. I always forget what a shock places like this are for people who grew up in the clans back on Far Away. How are you coping? Bradley asked. Okay, I guess. I'm very conscious of trying to appear blasé about everything. That's good. When you stop making the effort, you'll be taking it all in your stride. Everything balances out. So now that you've seen the Commonwealth, or some of it, what do you think? Are we right, trying to save it? Even if it wasn't worth saving, we are. People, I mean. Human beings. Our race. Bradley smiled out across the ocean, taking a deep breath of the fresh breeze. Right or wrong? He shrugged. Sorry, that's a misquote from before your time. Before mine, too, actually. So you think it's worth saving, then? Yes. It's not perfect. I think they could have done a lot better with all the knowledge and resources they have at their disposal. So many things are hard for people, when they don't need to be. Ah, an idealist. Bradley laughed softly. Try not to let Adam corrupt you too much about what shape society should take when we're victorious. He's a disgraceful old revolutionary rogue. Very helpful, though. What does he do? You'll find out when you meet him. He's going to take over from Stig now. Casimir stopped. They were still 300 meters from the pier. People were wandering down onto the beach from the bridge road that connected it with the land. A whole section just in front of him had been roped off. A city lifeguard stood by the entrance gate. There was nobody inside it. Do you know who that's for? Bradley asked. No. It's for children, so they can enjoy the beach together without having to share it with a whole bunch of adults hanging around spoiling it for them. They're getting to be a rare commodity on Earth these days. At least for the middle classes, who can't really afford to have them anymore. Though they still do, of course. That's human nature for you. It never ceases to amaze me what we'll go through, the sacrifices we'll make, so our kids can enjoy their childhood. That's the one part of life which our technology can never reproduce. Yet, after porn, it's the most popular TSI genre. I guess none of us really forget the wonder and joy which that innocence brought us. Psychologists always say we crave the sanctuary of the womb. Bunch of overeducated idiots, if you ask me. This is what we actually want. Times when every day is fresh and exciting, and the only worry is if the ice cream is going to last. It doesn't understand that, you know? The Starflyer. Yes. For all its intelligence, and it is very clever, Casimir, it cannot grasp this part of us. It has never understood how important our children are to us, the bond of love and adoration which exists between us. Partly because its life cycle doesn't include offspring in our fashion, but mainly because it regards them with contempt. It believes they cannot affect it, therefore it ignores them. I seriously believe that could be its downfall. Our nature. The one thing it believes it controls because it does comprehend our greed and our fear. But we're more than that, Casimir. We are more complex than it thinks. I'll do whatever I can to help. You know that, sir. I do. You've shown your loyalty to our cause many times.
You mentioned that this Adam person will take over from Stig. Does that mean I passed?
Bradley turned back from the ocean to give Casimir a broad, urbane smile.
Passed.
Passed what?
The test. Your approval, sir.
Bradley draped a long arm around Casimir's shoulder and urged him on around the back of the roped-off area.
Believe me, my dear boy, if I hadn't approved of you, you'd still be standing on the beach wondering where the hell I'd got to.
Or worse. Casimir glanced around, seeing the flash of judgment in the old man's eyes. It was more disturbing than any diatribe of threats and sneering.
I need the strongest the clans can produce for the task ahead, Bradley said.
You know that, don't you, Casimir? You will be asked to do many unpleasant things. If I deem it necessary, I will ask you to die so that we can grant far away its revenge.
Despite the moist air blowing in off the ocean, Casimir's mouth was dry.
I know.
Bradley's hand squeezed strongly. I don't feel guilty. What I went through, everything I endured as that monster's slave, left me with too much determination to feel that weak. Once this is over, I expect I will grieve for everything we have done, for the lives we have sacrificed. But it will be worth it, for we will be truly free again.
What was it like, sir? What did the Starflyer look like?
I don't remember.
Bradley shook his head, sorrow tainting his voice.
Not anymore.
The Sylphon took that away when they cured me.
I suppose they had their reasons.
The regret faded from his face.
When this is over, you should try walking the paths they've built between worlds. It's an extraordinary galaxy out there, Casimir.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Bradley stuck his hand out. Goodbye, Casimir. Thank you again for the opportunity to meet you. I consider myself honored that you and your kin continue to sustain the cause.
Casimir shook the hand enthusiastically, smiled a fraction nervously, and went back down the beach.
Bradley watched him go for a few moments, then went up the set of broad concrete stairs at the side of the pier.
He walked back along Ocean Avenue, through the narrow strip of lush greenery that was Palisades Park, with its centuries-old eucalyptus trees and ornate flower beds. Garden bots were patrolling the plants, snipping off dead flowers and trimming any errant shoots that threatened symmetry.
Water droplets glistened on the tough grass from the pre-dawn irrigation sprinkling.
On the other side of the broad street, the bold geometric skyline of condos presented their tiers of perfectly parallel balconies to the beach far below. Right in the middle of the gleaming new architecture, their skyline took a sudden dip down, allowing the sunlight to shine on a small 1930s hotel, the Georgian, with its Art Deco facade painted eggshell blue. Various brass plaques outside proclaimed the companies and civic authorities that had provided funds down the centuries to preserve the building, easily the oldest in the city. It had a raised concrete veranda along the front, with several tables underneath, a yellow and pink striped awning. Adam Elvin was sitting at one, eating his breakfast as he looked out across the park and ocean beyond. Bradley went up the steps and joined him.
So what's he like? Adam asked.
Depressingly young, trustworthy and honest, and hugely loyal to the cause.
Great. Another fanatic robot. Just what I need.
He's smart. You'll get along fine.
By the way, I like your new face. Dignified, yet with a hint of Street Fighter in the past.
Very you.
Adam grunted dismissively.
A waiter arrived and asked what Bradley wanted.
Same as my friend, please. Bradley indicated the plate of pancakes, bacon and syrup that Adam was rapidly demolishing.
With a glass of fresh orange and passion fruit juice and some English breakfast tea, thank you.
Yes, sir. The waiter smiled and went back inside.
Bradley tried to place the accent. One of the Baltic worlds in Phase 2 space? The waiter would be an off-worlder on a service company contract, as were nearly all human staff on Earth nowadays. After all, Earth natives would need much better-paying jobs so they could afford to live on their planet.
So, this must be quite the experience for you, Bradley said, the last socialist in the universe having his first power breakfast in L.A.
Go fuck yourself.
What the hell happened on Venice Coast? Adam put his fork down and dabbed at his lips with a linen napkin.
I have no idea. It's only sheer luck that I'm not in some basement at the security agency right now, having my memories read. Christ! She was 50 meters away, Bradley. I could have whispered hello to her. It's never been that close before. Never. Why couldn't you warn me? Your cover has always been superb. It's one of the reasons I keep doing this for you. I don't know. My usual source hasn't been in contact for some time. I find that rather disturbing. It's not someone who could easily be eliminated from Commonwealth life. The Starflyer got rid of them? You say that with so much skepticism, even now. But no, if it was that powerful, I would be dead and the cause would be lost. Don't be so quick to class me in there with the Skeptical Brigade. Remember what happened to poor old Ridgeon 2 days after I dodged Paul Amayo? That was a goddamn superthermal charge which took out the Nystole Gallery. Now, much as I despise and distrust our government, I don't see them doing that. There were 15 body deaths in the neighboring buildings when the gallery blew up. This was somebody else. It's not like the Starflyer to be so public, Bradley said. What would be the point? The shipment was compromised the moment the agency discovered it. We were never going to receive those components. You told me its plans were reaching the last stage. Maybe it wanted to make sure we weren't going to get hold of those components. It can't risk us screwing it now. Bradley smiled at the waiter as he reappeared with a glass of juice and a pot of tea. I'm glad it was you who suggested that. It adds credibility, from your point of view, he told Adam. I've been considering the possibility ever since it happened. You have a lot of contacts with the mercenary agents. Do any of them know anything about the man who attacked the gallery? No, there isn't even a rumor about him. Whoever he was, the armament systems he must have had wet-wired in were very sophisticated. Even I would have trouble acquiring those kinds of systems for you. They're all cutting-edge stuff. Governments get very edgy about who they're sold to. Someone put a lot of effort into the operation. If it really is the Starflyer becoming more overt, it's a disturbing development. We have a lot of materiel to get to far away if I am to bring about the planet's revenge. With her new expanded agency, Paul Amayo is becoming unpleasantly efficient at uncovering and halting our shipments. We can't afford to get hit from two different directions at once. And I can see the time coming when every piece of cargo for far away will be stopped and examined on Boongate. He paused to pour some tea out. As I remember, we did discuss blockade running once before. As an emergency option. Given our current situation, I believe a small amount of forward planning in that direction might be appropriate at this time. Damn it. Okay. I'll look into it. Thank you. I have two other small requests for you. Yeah. The data we're expecting from Mars, I don't want it routed to far away via the Unisphere. There are too many options for interception and corruption, especially if the Starflyer is monitoring us. All right. That's easy enough. We'll load it onto a memory cell and use a courier. Take it through physically. Fine. Someone like Casimir, for example. Let's just see how he works out on an ordinary run first, shall we? What's your second problem? I've been trying to talk to Wilson Keim. It's not easy. He's well guarded, physically and electronically. He's on the Conway. They should be at Dyson Alpha by now. Nonetheless, when he returns, I would appreciate contacting him somehow. What exactly do you want to talk to him about? I assumed you consider him to be a Starflyer agent. No, I don't believe he is. That's why I want to try and convert him. Adam had to swallow his coffee quickly before he choked on it. Convert Commander Keim? The head of the Starflight Agency? You've got to be kidding. Fortune favors the brave. Yeah, the brave, not the insane. I've watched him in interviews. He knows something wasn't right about losing Bose and Verbicky. That gives us an opening. An opening for what? To expose the Starflyer. Keim should be able to find the evidence of its treachery on board the Second Chance. What treachery? The Second Chance switched the barrier off, obviously. It couldn't have. We don't even begin to understand the physics behind the barrier. God, man, didn't you access the images of the Dark Fortress? Yes, but humans didn't switch the barrier off. The Starflyer did. How the hell did it know how to do that?
It is old. It has travelled a long way. I assume the Dyson pair are a part of its history.
You and your assumptions.
Did its species put up the barrier? I don't know, Adam. I wish I did. I wish I knew what it was doing to us. And why. But I don't. All I can do is try and block its schemes and warn people.
People like Kaim.
Yes.
Why?
I mean, of all the people you could try to convince, why Kaim? Because of his position. He can order another review of the second chance data. I've gone over everything CST released a dozen times, but all they've ever given to the media are the visual recordings. I need the ship's system logs.
What do you think is there?
Proof that second chance switched off the barrier. Proof that losing Bose and Verbeke was no accident. Kaim knows something is not right. He's ready to believe. He just needs a little nudge in the right direction.
CST has been over every bite from the flight a dozen times, not to mention all the media companies and government departments.
It's been analyzed by the best experts in the Commonwealth.
They found nothing. No irregularities. No anomalies. No stowaways.
They don't know what they are looking for. I can tell him where to search. With the kind of evidence I know is in there, we can make him realize the true threat to humanity. The whole truth about the Starflyer can finally be dragged out into the public domain. The Commonwealth leadership will be forced to acknowledge we were right all along. You and I won't have to sneak around in the shadows anymore. Faraway can have its revenge without us having to...
All right, all right.
Adam held his hands up. Stop the preaching, I get the picture. But I doubt I'll be able to get any closer to Kaim than you can. And even if I did, I'm not the nutter with a cause who might at least raise a doubt in his mind. I'm just a wanted killer who's taken up arms smuggling and, incidentally, organized an attack on Second Chance while he was up there in it. That's not exactly the kind of credibility we need to grab his attention. I am aware of that. We need to come at him from an angle. Fortunately, there's someone else in the Starflight Agency who will listen to you. Someone who has complete access to Kaim. The look Adam shot across the table was more outrage than shock.
No way. I am not speaking to him. I am not contacting him. I'm not sending him a message file. I'm not even going to visit the same planet he's on. I will not do that. Not for you, not for money, not for your stupid cause. Not if Karl Marx came back to ask me personally. Understand? That is the past. He made his choice. I made mine. End of story. Period. Finish. It is over.
Ah. Bradley took a sip of his tea. Shame about that.
After a thoroughly decent evening meal in a bar that specialized in seafood, Casimir walked the few blocks back to his small hotel. It was a balmy night, so he made a slight detour to take in Palisades Park. In darkness, the park had ribbons of illumination to highlight its plants and trees, bathing them in bubbles of colored lights to contrast with their own shades. Out to sea, the funfair on the pier was a continual blaze of multicolored light, reflecting off the black water. Ocean Avenue was busy with people who wound their way between bars and restaurants and clubs, exploiting the city's vibrant nightlife culture to kick back and relax after their working day. The clubs had immaculately dressed doormen outside, operating strict entrance policies. Little clumps of hopefuls clustered outside, while limos came and went, depositing those who'd made it onto the list. Casimir lingered opposite a few of the clubs, casually interested to see if he could spot any celebrities. One thing Los Angeles had clung to resolutely down the centuries was its status as capital of the entertainment world. He didn't see anyone he recognized from the short time he'd been exposed to the Unisphere, but then it was very early in the evening. Hanging over the city, a three-quarters moon shone brightly enough to establish a small haze around it. He paused to stare up at it, fascinated by the wide jet-black equatorial band bisecting the globe, as if a loop of space itself had been wrapped around the swan silver regolith. Established in 2190, the global solar power farm had grown from three patches of solar panels spaced equidistantly around the moon's equator so that one of them was always in full sunlight, until it now ringed the entire circumference. It had become Earth's main source of electricity. In an age when environmental laws reigned supreme, and the pollution legacy of the 20th and 21st centuries had almost been eradicated, it was inconceivable to build any kind of fuel-burning power station on Earth. Instead, it was done cleanly and efficiently off-planet. The power that the ring generated was transferred to Earth via micro-wormholes, where it was distributed over continental superconductor grids. Casimir enjoyed the elegance of the idea. It was amusing to think that the electricity that lit the row of condos looming along the other side of the park, as well as the funfair, had all come from the moon. It was nice that nothing had to be burned, fused, or fissioned to keep a whole planet supplied. The expense was phenomenal, but that was just a question of priorities. Once the lunar factories had been established, they just kept on churning out more solar cells indefinitely, processing them out of moon rock. Adam Elvin had commented on the arrangement, admiring it while simultaneously deploring the fact no other planet had made a similar investment. Casimir then had to sit and listen, over a perfectly good lunch, to the plethora of reasons why corporate economics, evil grand families, and the intersolar stock market prevented the rest of the human race from sharing the benefits of civilization in a fair and just fashion. In fact, Adam Elvin had a great many complaints about the economic oppression practiced across the Commonwealth. Casimir knew he was never going to like his new colleague. He could work with him. The old man had a lot to teach him about the smuggling and deception techniques that would assist the Guardians, but he could never envisage going out with him and hitting a few bars in the evening as friends would. As the lunch drew to its end, Adam had slipped him a memory crystal disc. It contains a list of items Bradley needs for this revenge project of his. It's all very high-tech stuff, the kind in plentiful supply on Earth. I've given you the names of possible suppliers, and the kinds of covers I want you to establish in order to make contact. The payment methods have also been set up. I understand. I want you to go back to your hotel. Study it. Come up with proposals how you'd handle each one. What you'll need, everything from clothes to a tourist TSI, bought in the district you're supposed to have come from. We'll meet again in 2 days, and I'll review what you've got. Okay. We meet in person. Yes. Care to tell me why? The cybersphere is susceptible to monitoring even if we encrypt. In fact, especially if we encrypt. Meetings can be spotted and observed, but it's a question of balance. You obviously believe it's the less risky option for the location and situation. Very good. It's nice to know Stig was actually listening to me. We'll turn you into a covert operative yet, Casimir McFoster. Casimir had spent the afternoon reviewing the list and making notes. He kept his proposals straightforward. Complexity in this kind of operation could trip you up. He was sure that simplicity was the key. It would be interesting to hear what Elvin said about his tradecraft. Most of the time he had spent researching through the Unisphere. Hundreds of separate queries had returned dozens of answers. It was a question of sifting through them and deciding how they could be applied. Stig had always warned him the job would be boring for 99% of the time. He started walking through the park again, alert for any signs of an observation team boxing him. Of course, there was one query he had stoically resisted launching into the Unisphere ever since he received his first insert, and he could never break cover to make contact with a civilian while he was on a mission as important as this one. He just couldn't. He reached the end of Palisades Park and crossed over to Colorado Avenue. 5 minutes later, he was back in his hotel room. Air conditioning reduced the temperature to comfortable. The darkened glass of the window let in few specks of light, hinting at the city grid outside. There were almost no sounds from the traffic. He kicked off his trainers and flopped back on the bed's gel mattress. It was far too early to sleep. Any good, dependable Guardian member would carry on planning to acquire the items needed back on Far Away. Casimir closed his eyes and saw the darkness of the tent after night had fallen on Mount Herculaneum. Starlight showed the dusky outline of the angel's face as she rose above him. She smiled, proud of him and excited by him, by the things she confessed in low whispers that she wanted him to do. Nothing in his life had ever come close to the wonder of that time. No girl had, could ever match her in any respect. He'd gone on with his life, accepted that nothing would ever be that good again, knowing he could put it all behind him because he would never see her again. She was on Earth, and he was on far away, a safe 400 light-years distant. And so it would remain, forever.
God damn it!
He shouted to the room. He lurched up and came close to slapping himself. Instead, he took a breath, perched on the end of the bed, and told his e-butler to open a link to the planetary cybersphere. I want an identity check on an Earth citizen, he told his e-butler. See if there's any reference available on Justine Benelli.
I ought to be getting used to this, Paula thought. She wasn't, though.
And that was far more painful than any irony. For once, she'd gone to Mel Reese's office. It was a political thing. This was her mess, her responsibility, once again. Not that it was any comfort, but Mel Reese seemed to be just as unhappy about the meeting. His office was only marginally bigger than the one she occupied, although his view of the Eiffel Tower was a lot better. The door closed behind her, and he sat behind a big old walnut desk that was devoid of any clutter. So what happened? He asked.
I don't know.
For Christ's sake, Paula, some psycho takes out a half block of Venice coast, kills 19 people in the process, and you don't know. This is not a good start for the agency. Columbia is demanding results, and he's not using nice language to ask. I am aware of the agency's situation. What happened out there concerns me a lot more. I understand how concerned you are. He hesitated, winding himself up, like a doctor preparing to break bad news. You've been on this case a long time. Maybe... No, she said flatly. It is not time for me to move on and hand over to someone else.
Reese didn't argue. He seemed to shrink a little further behind his desk.
All right. But be warned, Paula. There are questions being raised about your suitability. Things are different here now, and they're going to change even more. If the order comes down to move you on, it isn't one that I'll be able to shield you from. If it wasn't for your record outside the Guardian's case, I am aware of how my reputation protects me, and you know none of your other investigators would be able to run Johansson down.
Yeah,
the thought was visibly worrying him. So what can you tell me about Venice Coast?
I've been supervising the forensics operation, trying to reconstruct the sequence of events. It added very little to what we already know.
She told her e-butler to run a file on the deputy director's wall-mounted portal. It produced an image from one of the observation team's sensors, showing the man poised in Regan's shattered office window the moment before he dived into the canal.
The face is unknown to any database, so we assume it's a cellular reprofiling. There's no visual sensor image of him arriving or leaving Anacona at the CST station.
A native, then?
Unlikely, but we haven't ruled out the possibility. As far as we can determine, his weapon systems were all wet-wired, with the exception of a simple arm dispenser. We recovered the receptionist's memory cell and read the last 10 minutes. I acquired it myself.
The memory was now as clear as any of her own. She could recall the man walking into the gallery. She'd sat up a little straighter behind the reception desk, smiling when she noticed his youth and looks. Then his arm was raised, something moving below the jacket sleeve. There was nothing else. No time for her to feel pain, or horror, or fear. Death had been instantaneous.
We were lucky to get that, she said.
The way the gallery was built meant the ground floor had a degree of protection from the plasma surge after the blast. There were other bodies down there, but they were 90% vaporized. And the bodyguard, Roberto, he was fortunate too. His armor frame wasn't exactly designed with a superthermal charge in mind, but its deflector field did provide some shielding. The frame's processors contained some interesting records. Just before the blast, it had managed to ward off an ion pulse. Then the armor received some terrible physical impacts. Someone used poor Roberto as a punching bag. Our intruder was one sophisticated boy. I asked our new colleagues in the Enforcement Directorate what it would take to build someone up to that standard. They actually had trouble working out the specs for me. Wet-wired force fields are cutting edge. Mel took a long, disapproving glance at the image in the portal.
Do you think Johansson has a lot of them?
I don't think he's Johansson's at all. Elvin hasn't acquired this kind of capability. Besides, he wrecked Elvin's operation. No, he was sent by someone else. Any guesses? Logically, there are three possibilities. A deep Commonwealth Security Department sent him in, something we're not cleared to know about. There have always been rumors about the executive office having its own intelligence sector. Why they'd use an operative in this instance, I don't know, unless it was to send a very clear message to Johansson that we're not going to tolerate him anymore. The same applies to CST. They could certainly put someone like this together, and they're not likely to forgive or forget the sabotage attempt on the second chance. And the third possibility? The Starflyer sent him.
Oh, come on!
It's an option, you have to admit that. No, I don't. What about Regan's enemies? He was a black market arms merchant, for God's sake. His kind don't settle disagreements over a meal and a bottle of wine. A rival wouldn't bother destroying the equipment Regan was collecting. They wouldn't even know about it. No, the timing indicates someone who had the same information we did. That fits the first two possibilities. Our operations are available to the executive. It might even fit the third. No, Paula, no. There is no third option. The Starflyer is a cult conspiracy theory. You do not include it in any official report. If you do, I will not even attempt to cover your ass. Don't you see how political this is? It had to be the president or CST. We can investigate many things, but not them. Nobody is above the law. Damn it! If the executive authorized it, then it is lawful. Same for CST. God, Sheldon and Ozzy own whole planets, including a Big 15. They are governments. That doesn't make what happened right. They killed people. Don't do this, Paula. Mel was almost pleading. Let me talk to Columbia. Let me find out if this is safe. You never know, I might actually be right. It might have been one of Regan's enemies. She considered the request. Very well. I'll complete the investigation into the gallery explosion itself. How it is carried forward after that, and who it's assigned to, will be your call. Seriously?
Yes.
Why? He asked suspiciously. If the investigation is blocked politically, it will be because it was either CST or the executive which ordered the assault, in which case I'm not interested. Not that I don't want to see justice done, but it would not ever be possible to achieve justice in those circumstances. I would be wasting my time, which I could be using to pursue Johansson and Elvin. If Columbia wants us to proceed, then that's a different matter. If we get the all clear, it'll be to find out who Regan was at war with. Do you really want to spend time on that? You've got the resources to track down Johansson now. If we get the all clear, you and I will need to know which of us is right. So do you want the case? I'll let you know when you bring an answer from Columbia. Until then, I'm still dedicating the team to finding Johansson. Okay. I can live with that. There's something else I want you to raise with Columbia. Yes. Elvin was after some very advanced equipment. I really think it's time for every export to far away to be searched. Our current policy of random checks is simply not acceptable anymore. Not that it ever was to me. I'll put it on the agenda.
Good.
Osher Finn was just sitting down to supper when the apartment's door sensors showed him who was approaching. He muttered, "Holy shit," and stood bolt upright. His wife, Inima, gave him a surprised look, then glanced at the little screen showing the camera picture.
"Isn't that..."
"Yep." Osher went through the living room and arrived at the door the same time as Paula Mayo. "Is something wrong?" he asked after he'd invited her in.
"No, everything is fine, thank you."
She looked him up and down.
"You've lost some weight."
"Not before time," Inima said, giving him a shy glance. "We're considering having a child." Paula produced a genuine smile.
"Congratulations.
Will you be carrying it?"
"Heavens, no,"
Inima said. "It will be a vitro womb pregnancy."
"Right."
That seemed to exhaust the investigator's small talk.
Hosha and Inema exchanged a mildly bewildered look.
"Do you want to join us for supper?"
Inema asked.
"No, thank you. It's mid-afternoon, Paris time. I caught the express."
"We can talk on the balcony if you'd like,"
Hosha said as his wife shot him a desperate glare.
"If you don't mind," Paula said.
"I'll just get on with catching up on some work," Inema assured her. The balcony of the little apartment barely had room for the small round table and two chairs that were pressed up against the railing. Hosha shuffled around the table and sat down. Paula stood by the rail, taking in the view. The 30-story apartment block was in Dark Lake City's Malakoy district, a long way back from the shore. Paula could look out and see the parks and elaborate buildings that meandered along the shoreline. She could even pick out the tower behind the big marina where Morton used to live.
"You have a nice home, Hosha.
Why are you here?" She left the rail and sat opposite him.
"I need some detective work done. This is not an official request. It's a favor," he supplied gently.
"Yes. You don't like working outside channels, do you, Paula?"
"I don't have a lot of choice in this particular case. I believe my agency is compromised. That's why I've come to you, and a few others I worked with outside the old directorate. You can make inquiries that won't be registered in our office."
"Compromised by whom?"
"I'm not sure. But they will be very highly placed inside the Commonwealth government, perhaps even the executive itself. If they find out about this, it won't exactly help your career."
"What have they done?"
"What they always do, play politics and maneuver among their own kind. But this time it's resulted in people being killed."
"Okay. What do you need?"
"Have you seen the recordings of the Venice Coast bomb?"
"Hell yes. Melanie has been playing them just about non-stop."
"Melanie?" Paula hesitated. "Melanie Rescari?"
"None other. I sometimes think I did the wrong thing letting the demon out of the bottle."
"You let genies out of bottles, Hosha, not demons."
"Not in this case, believe me. After the court case, she went on and made some softcore TSI biog drama. Murderous seduction. Did you access it?"
"No."
"It got a huge rating. The actor playing me looked like a sumo wrestler, for heaven's sake. They got you about right, though. Anyway, Melanie won a lot of media attention. Certainly locally. So Alessandra Barron took her on as Oak Tears rep for her show. She's actually quite good. I think she's got her own personality line as well. All the usual crap. Swimwear, holograms, monthly TSI releases, scents, food. There's even a murderous seduction cocktail. She's got quite a fan club these days."
"Strange. She didn't seem the type. I don't normally underestimate people so poorly."
"Yeah, there's some politicians she interviewed who made that mistake when she started out. They don't anymore."
"And she's been showing the Venice Coast recordings?"
"Every news show has. I just watched her because she gets the decent interviews. It was one of Rafael Columbia's deputies, I think." He gave Paula a cautious glance. "Melanie was really pressing the point about how you kept fouling up the Johansson case."
"Her words."
"I'm sure. So where do I tie in with what happened on Venice Coast?"
"This is not public knowledge. But not all of the equipment Regan was collecting got destroyed in the blast. Several items were being stored downstairs. We managed to retrieve them."
"What kind of items?"
"One was a very high-power superconducting microphase modulator. Its regulator software was modified by a fix that apparently came from the Chancerel Partnership. That's a specialist software house right here in Dark Lake City. Elvin couldn't have placed a regular order for it. This is really technical stuff. They would need an expert brief. And, Hosha, they would have known it wasn't a legitimate contract."
"What was the modulator used for?"
A slight frown crossed Paula's forehead.
"We're not sure.
The best guess forensics could come up with from the items we know were delivered is some kind of customized force field, though that doesn't explain half of the components."
"Okay. So you want me to look into the Chancerel Partnership?"
"Please. Yes.
What exactly am I hunting for?"
And how much pressure do you want me to put on these guys? I want to know how deep their connection with Alvin goes. If it's long-term, or if they were just short of money one time and took a no-questions contract to get the bank off their backs. I'm hoping for the long-term, of course. That way I can run a deep cover tracker on their contact with Alvin's team. How you want to play it is up to you. There's always a weak link in any group of people. See if you can find which one it is in Chancerel and make them sweat. Okay, but I'm puzzled by this. You're going after Alvin. How does that help you with the agency's internal leak? Standard elimination entrapment. Each suspect is given a different piece of information in isolation. Then I sit back and see who reacts. Decades ago, Thompson Benelli had made a huge mistake. He assumed that because he was a man and relatively fit, that because his reach and strength gave him an advantage, he would beat Paula Mayo at squash. He was good at squash. No false modesty. Whenever he was in Washington, he could visit the Clinton estate, his ultra-exclusive social and sports club, where no small percentage of intersolar government business was conducted. Two or three times a week he would play his fellow senators, or their aides, or some committee chair, or a grand family representative. Standards were high, and the estate's professional was an excellent coach if any part of his game should slip. With Paula Mayo, he learned that placement and precision were everything. She barely moved out of the center of the court, from where she sent the ball slamming into places he wasn't, every time. He had staggered out afterward, red-faced, slick with sweat, and fearing for his pounding heart. It was 11 years before he finally won a game. 2 years after a rejuvenation, when he was at his absolute physical peak, while she was due into rejuvenation in another 3 years. So their cycle continued over the decades. Right now, she wasn't 10 years out of rejuvenation, and he didn't care about points. His only concern was to avoid a coronary before he lost, dashing from one side of the court to the other, chasing after her calm shots. Anyone else he played who lacked, perhaps, his status or seniority, aides, lobbyists, new senators, would allow him to win the odd game. Not every game, but enough to make him feel good. It was simple politics. That would never apply to Paula. It took him a while, but eventually he worked out why. Throwing a game would be dishonest, the one thing she could never be. When the torment was over, he grabbed a towel and wiped the rivers of sweat from his face. From the ache in his leg muscles, he knew he was going to be stiff for a week. "See you in the bar," he groaned, and slowly made his way to the sanctuary of the gentleman's locker room. 40 minutes later, with at least some of the pain eased by a hot massage shower, he walked into the bar. The Clinton estate was barely 2.5 centuries old, but from darkened oak paneling and high-backed leather chairs, the bar could have dated back to the late 19th century. Even the staff looked the part, dressed in their scarlet jackets and white gloves. Paula was already sitting in a big leather wing chair, in one of the bay windows that gave a sweeping view out over the estate's formal gardens. With her smart suit and perfectly brushed hair reaching just below her shoulders, she had the kind of easy poise that women from the grand family spent decades trying to achieve. "Bourbon," Thompson told the waiter as he eased himself into the chair opposite her. A light smile touched Paula's lips at the tone of the order, as if she'd scored another point. "So did Raphael give you a hard time over Venice Coast?" he asked. "Let's say I was made aware he was unhappy. People see it as another victory for Alvin and Johansson over me. They are quite blind to what it actually signifies. That we have a new player in town. Not new, but one that has become visible for the first time. You still believe there's a mole in the executive office? Or a grand family? Or an intersolar dynasty? You're the ones with the permanent connections, after all. Rumor in the Senate Hall dining room is that you told Mel Rees it could be the Starflyer. It is a possibility. I'm sure it's logical, but, Paula, it's not popular, just so you know. There are some planetary parliaments who have elected people who support the Guardians. Not many, and it was all proportional representation votes. But the fact that anyone like that can gather support is worrying.
Oh, I know it's not popular. It's not something I'm actively pursuing.
That doesn't sound like you. I can't do my job if I don't have a job.
Thompson greeted the arrival of his bourbon with a relieved grin.
We all get backed into corners. I'm sorry. It must be especially hard for you.
I said actively pursuing, as the old prison saying went, they've only got your body behind bars.
I see. So what can I do to help?
I need to know if there really is a secret security section which is only answerable to the executive.
No, there isn't. And I should know. Our family actually predates the Commonwealth.
I can check with my father to be absolutely certain.
Please do. It's important.
It wasn't what Thompson expected. Nobody ever questioned him. But then that was what made Paula so refreshing. They had started their association all those years ago with a quick exchange of information. She was after one of the Tsarin Prime Minister's staff, while he was trying to steer a bill on infrastructure tax credits through the Senate, which Tsarin was opposing. Ever since then, they had swapped facts and gossip on politics and criminals. Thompson wasn't sure if they were friends, but the relationship had certainly been rewarding for both of them, and he knew he could trust Paula implicitly, which was just about unique in the circles he moved through.
Okay, what if there is?
Will you try and arrest the president? Poor old Doy only just got in, and that was on a miserable percentage.
The fact that Colombia hasn't blocked the Venice Coast investigation suggests that situation won't arise. I'm just eliminating possibilities at this stage, that's all.
Then let me tell you that I don't know of any grand family who'd do such a thing. We've no reason to. Far away and the Guardian terrorists don't have any impact on our activities and money.
Which leaves us with Nigel Sheldon, who you will never arrest.
I know.
Not that the order would have come from Sheldon himself anyway. Some fifth-level family executive will be trying to earn themselves points.
That wouldn't surprise me. Although, we don't have any solid evidence that Regan was ever working for Adam Elvin in the first place.
You don't?
No.
What we were observing resembled one of his smuggling shipments, that's all. Although there is one major difference. The nature of the equipment Regan was collecting.
I skimmed the report. It was all high-tech stuff.
Yes.
But no weapons.
If it genuinely was Elvin's shipment, that would suggest Johansson is moving into a new phase of activity.
I've no idea what, but there's a very simple way to prevent it.
Which is?
A full examination of every piece of cargo shipped to far away. I've been arguing this for years. Decades, actually. Every time I get the same answer, it costs too much. And delays play hell with transport scheduling, especially with Halfway's wormhole cycle.
What did Raphael say?
That he would press for it. But there's been no movement. I need someone with real clout to implement the policy.
You.
Raphael has real clout, believe me. Some of us are getting worried about how much.
And all I can say is he's not using it to support my request.
Probably pissed at you for Venice Coast. His shiny new agency didn't look good in the aftermath.
Did you watch any of the news shows? The editorials weren't friendly.
Alessandro Baron even took a swipe at you personally.
So I heard, Paula said dryly,
but that should not affect Colombia's judgment on this issue.
Would you lobby the president for me on this, Thompson?
It will annoy the Halgarths. They're the only intrasolar dynasty who have any real involvement with Far Away. But if you assure me it's necessary, then, of course, I'll use what influence we have. Right now, Doy is indebted to my family. She should be eager to grant us something like this.
Thank you.